Janine draws on more than 40 years of professional experience to empower teachers and parents. As a certified human behavior consultant and specialist and owner of the Fitzgerald Institute of Lifelong Learning, Janine specializes in research-based strategies that maximize the fulfillment of a child's potential and their implementation in real-life settings. She understands the daily struggles of educators and parents and honors the hero within each individual she has the privilege to work alongside. As a speaker, consultant, and master trainer, Janine's worked with thousands of children, professionals, and parents across the country. As an author, Janine has published The Dance of Interaction and two national training programs entitled Education with Insight and Parenting with Insight. She's currently putting the finishing touches on her second book, Educating the Heart. Thank you so much, Janine, for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
The floor is yours.
All right. Welcome, everybody. I am aware that there was some interest related to our current pandemic and how that's influencing regulation and what we might expect in children. So I thought maybe that was a place for us to start. But in general, what we're going to go through is what you see as the overview of the session, the developmental progression of regulation. So we're going to be answering some questions like, what is this thing called regulation? How does it connect to what we understand about brain development? And, you know, where do we even begin? And so I just thought we would step back a bit and say, you know, our children have been through quite a bit through this pandemic, as have we as the adults in their lives. So, you know, folks have been asking, you know, what can we expect when we come out the other side? I don't have any answers for that. Although I do know this, that there's a lot of stress going on right now. And that stress is pretty serious business because it really is not a normal state of being. So when we experience stress, what we say is that stress response that we see generally is the body's way of screaming out that something needs to be adjusted, something needs to change. And so what we understand about young children is that they are more vulnerable to stress than adults. And so if we look at our own level of stress and what that's done to our own levels of regulation, because basically we as adults like sort of have a pattern that we like to live our life in. And when it gets sidetracked, it puts us into disequilibrium. So children are more vulnerable. And the reason they're more vulnerable is because they have less access to coping mechanisms, ways in which to cope. And they really don't have a true understanding of what happened, why it happened. And being egocentric, there's a likelihood that they will begin to think that it was their fault, that these bad things are happening. So we do take the stress of children seriously. We tend to, as a society, underestimate the amount of stress that children actually experience. But when they do experience that level of stress, as they may be right now, you know, basically they're going to go into a fight or flight kind of response. Although some children will go into freeze, which is the default. When fight or flight isn't available, then we freeze. We just numb. And so, you know, as we start to look at what might we expect from children, as we work with them, you know, I know in Massachusetts, we're just starting to open up again. And so, you know, the work that we do is last on the agenda. I think we're wave 5 or something, which puts us who knows when that's going to happen. But I think what we can expect to see is some regressive patterns of behavior in children that would be very typical for kids. I think we can also expect that we're going to see in children some heightened anger in children. We're going to see heightened sadness in some children and heightened fear in some children. And those would all be natural reactions. So there's another set of children that we're probably going to see a heightened sense of restlessness, sort of this irritability, wanting to move more frequently, what we would describe as fidgeting. Or with some kids, we may see as part of their fear response, we may see that, you know, there's some daydreaming going on or some just inability to pay attention or to concentrate. So I think that's what we can anticipate. And you know, all of those are forms of dysregulation, which we would expect to see. Worst case scenario is that we have dysregulated children with dysregulated adults, because that's like the perfect storm. so we'll try to work on some of that tonight. You know, where do we begin? Because really this topic of self-regulation is quite extensive. It's actually a graduate course that I teach, but we'll give you the highlights. So as you look at, you know, the PowerPoint and you go through, the first slide is like self-regulation, what is it? And the definition of self-regulation is it's a complex set of functions. And you say, what do those functions do? They're the functions that exert influence over all of our internal sensations and states. And so, you know, if we don't have these functions in life, then the result obviously is dysregulation. And oftentimes dysregulation is perceived as chaos or some sort of diagnosis. And so it is true that every diagnosis that we see in children is nothing more than the way that we have of describing what is dysregulated. So if we have a diagnosis of anxiety, that's the dysregulation of thought. If we have the diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder, that's the dysregulation of your thoughts as well as your emotion. And then you can get into like ADHD, which is the dysregulation of attention, activity level, and then impulsivity. So we do have some children that are in dysregulation, and what we're seeing is explosiveness. You know, the children we are seeing impulsivity. As folks get older, you start to see things like substance abuse and violence, anxiety, some of the mood disorders and those sorts of things. So self-regulation is having that set of skills that really put you in the driver's seat of your life, that give you some sense of consistency over life. Whether it's consistent academic performance or it's consistent behavioral performance or social performance, but it's all about consistency. And so one of the things that seems to have happened over the years is that we've kind of lost focus as to what is the normal developmental pathway for the development of self-regulation. And we have this sense that we want all of our school children to go to school ready to learn. And that means by 5 years old, we want them to be regulated. The problem is that the developmental flow begins at the point of conception, and it continues until you get to your late 20s, 30th birthday. And so, you know, I'm well past my 30th birthday, and I'm just wondering when I'm going to become fully regulated, because I've come to realize that I don't think there's enough years in a lifetime to become fully regulated. But yet we're putting a lot of pressure on our children. So when we start to think about what is this developmental flow, we come into the world, we all come in, you know, sharing some similar sorts of things, like we come in naked at a very young age, and we all enter pretty much unregulated with the capacity to regulate, but it's going to require that we're in an environment that will support the development of those skills. And so the first level of regulation, we call it co-regulation, which means that we rely completely on a primary caregiver. So as an infant, we rely on that caregiver for soothing, feeding, sleeping, all of the functions of life. And then as we move through, we get to this place where we just need some external supports. That means that we're relying on caregivers when the situation is intense. And so, you know, I suppose when toddlers are developing this thing called autonomy, there's a lot of intense situations. It's like, but I want it, and I want it now, and you better give it to me. And if you don't, I will bite you. You know, we do see a lot of intensity, certainly more intensity of emotions in younger children than we hope to see in adults. Although I have interacted with many adults that don't seem to have progressed much further beyond external support. And so the ultimate goal is for us to get to self-regulation, is to be able to rely on ourselves in situations, the situations that we find ourselves in life. So as you look at that, you know, that it takes quite a period of time to figure out how to get yourself to this place where I truly am in control of all the internal states that I find myself experiencing. And so one of the ways that we look at this thing called self-regulation is through the brain development and, you know, the concept of the triune brain. And while we know a lot more today about neuroscience and those sorts of things, and this is somewhat of a simplistic way of looking at the brain, it does help us to begin to understand what's going on with regulation. So when you look at the triune brain, you see the picture, and then the slides that follow are going to be supports to this graphic. But what you see at the bottom is called the brainstem. So when we are building this system of self-regulation, it's like building a house. So you start with the most primitive of the frame, and then you move up to the more sophisticated aspects of the house. You have the roof that gets put on and all the special touches that go on. So the brain is very much the same way. So the brain stem is the most primitive part of the brain. It is the part of the brain that is responsible for the sensory input of life. And so there are certain behaviors that we see in our children that go along with these parts of the brain. And when you see those behaviors, it will tell you what part of the brain is dysregulated. And once you know what part of the brain is dysregulated, then you know what to do about it. So when the brain stem, the most primitive part of the brain, is unregulated, it is the sensory part of the brain. So what does that mean? It means that you're going to do things that put the sensory system back into a state of comfort, as opposed to the limbic system, which is the next level, that has to do with the emotional part of the brain. And so when we see certain behaviors coming out of the limbic system, we look at those behaviors and we say, oh, so this child needs some work with emotions regulation as opposed to sensory regulation. And then by the time you're 16 years old, that top part is starting to mature. That's called the prefrontal cortex. Many of us understand that's where our executive functions are. So all the things like complex problem solving and wise judgment and empathy and all of those things. The theory of all of this is that once that cortex, that prefrontal cortex develops, it becomes the oversight to the two primitive parts of the brain, and it keeps them in check. The problem is that many of us are working with children that aren't 16 years old yet. And so we have kids that are functioning predominantly from the brain stem and limbic part of the brain. And so you say, what does that mean? Well, there's certain things that you can't expect from children when they don't have the full functioning of the brain in its mastery. And so if we have young children and they're functioning from the brainstem and the limbic system, things that we wouldn't be able to expect from them because developmentally they're not at that place is they may not be able to regulate their emotions. And so I think many of us have probably experienced a child that goes from 0 to 60 in less than a second. And then, you know, it's a 4-hour meltdown and, you know, things like that, because they don't have the ability to fully regulate the emotions. Although in just a bit, we're going to be talking about that. How do we teach children to do that? Another thing that will be difficult for children if they don't have a strong cortex is they're not going to pause and think before they act. They're going to be highly impulsive. And so impulsivity is the norm for young children, as much as we don't like that. So they're going to blurt out at circle time, like, you know, I had pizza for breakfast, because you're talking about the color red and it triggered some association for them. And then if you say, oh, so was the color of the pizza sauce the same as the color of the leaves, trying to get them back on track, they're just going to blurt something else out, like, I have a hole in my shoe. Like, that's just the way their brain functions. It's very spontaneous. Like, it looks like fun. It sounds like fun. I need something right now. Here I go. The next thing that we probably can't expect from children when there's an unfinished brain is we're not going to be able to expect them to consider other people's perspectives. So sometimes I watch and I say, you know, so we have 2-year-olds and, you know, they're not sharing, but there are a lot of adults that think 2-year-olds should share. And so, and then they'll say things like, look at their face. How do you think they feel? And it's like the kids are thinking, I couldn't care less how they feel. Like, I got the Play-Doh. That was the goal. I got it. That's all that you need to know. And so, you know, some of the things that we're doing, like help asking them, how does somebody else feel? They don't even know how they feel yet. Oftentimes they can't even figure out the difference between if they feel sad or they're mad. So, you know, sometimes we have expectations that we place on children in hopes that they'll meet our expectations. But the reality is, in the field of behavior, we describe an expectation as a hope. That's simply what it is. It's a hope. I hope you will listen to me. I hope you will sit crisscross applesauce like a pretzel on your rug, square zip your lips, lock them, and throw away the key. The next thing that children without an unfinished upstairs in their brain will have difficulty with is considering the best options. And so a lot of times we're asking children to problem solve beyond their ability to problem solve. So can we come up with some alternatives? What do you think would be a better thing to do? Would you do the same thing? Would you do something different next time? For many of our kids, that's difficult to do. Those actual skills and questions are mastered by most children by the age of 7. It's not to say that we don't have children younger that can't do it, but it's not the majority of children. And then the last thing for us to consider as we look at this thing called self-regulation, without mastery of that cortex, children are not going to be very efficient at evaluating consequences. It's like when you say, if we don't, then we can't, they're like, I don't care. I couldn't care less. Like, I couldn't care because I'm not getting up off the floor. Like, this is just where I'm going to be. Like, you're not going to make me do anything. And so, you know, I want to put things in perspective and say, you know, we're working with young children. It's going to be a period of time before they get to the place where we would all like them to be by the age of 5 years old in today's world. But we just keep teaching and doing what we need to. So as you look at this triune brain, how do you know when a child is coming from the brainstem? What you're going to see, first of all, the brainstem is called the reptilian brain. And so you will see children that will either be in a fight or flight or freeze response, okay, when they're in dysregulation. So we know that fighting is externalizing, they act out. Flight is internalizing or holding in, and then freeze is totally shutting down. So what will we be observing so that we then know what is the most effective way to get the brain back into balance? So in the brainstem, if you're seeing the following fight behaviors from a child, so a child who decides that they're going to act out, what will we be looking for? Here's the behaviors. I'll talk a little bit slower so you can write some of these down. The fight response is about kicking, biting, screaming, hitting, spitting, throwing, pushing, punching, scratching, and hair pulling. So when we see behaviors similar to those or those behaviors, our mindset then goes to, this is a child that's in dysregulation. The behavior is serving a purpose. It's serving the purpose of handling the stress. And therefore, it's coming from the sensory part of the brain. So I have to do something to bring the sensory system back into balance. Okay. When a child is in the flight aspects of the brainstem, you're going to see the following patterns: hiding and running away. So, you know, in the field of behavior, we have really bizarre terms sometimes for things. So, you know, for us, running away is like bolting. That's what people say. However, in the field of behavior, it's called elopement. So, you know, You can have 2-year-olds eloping, apparently. I don't know. I don't understand that word and why you would use that word. But there are children that will hide, and there are children that will run away. And then when they get to the freeze response, what you tend to see is avoiding, totally shutting down. And so, you know, we have some children that will lay on the ground and they'll just refuse to move or refuse to transition from one place to another. And they're just sort of staring off into space. And my favorite question to ask kids when they're in freeze is, what are you wondering about right now? Because when you start to ask children what they wonder about, then the brain shifts away from sort of its current experience and it goes into thinking about what they're wondering about, which puts them back into the cortex. It shifts the chemistry. So when we see children that are in those patterns of behavior, that comes from the brainstem. And so what do we do? I'm going to give you the big pattern and then we're going to go into some of the specific skills to teach. So the first thing we would want to do, if a child is hurting themselves, others, or property, the first thing we would do is stop. Stop the child from hurting. Okay. But the second thing we would do is we ourselves would stop. So one of the worst things you can do when the sensory system is already in overload is to add more sensory input to something that's already in overload. And we do that because we start moving faster, we start talking faster, our voice goes up octaves, our hands stop flying all over the place, more than one person responds. Worst thing that we can do. So we too have to have regulatory functions. So one of our statements that we talk about in our in-depth work is that really discipline is a discipline that requires self-discipline. So for us to be helpful in the regulation with children.
I'm writing that down. That's a quote.
It sounds like a double talk, but it's really not. It's a discipline that requires self-discipline. And that's where I find we're in trouble, because we are living in a highly unregulated world. And so we're also in a place of what we call situational ethics. So there aren't a lot of people that are doing like self-discipline. Like, I'll discipline myself only if it serves me well. And other than that, forget about it. So we have to sort of stop, take a breath, regulate our own sort of whatever is going on within us before we add more sensory input to a brain that can't handle the sensory input it's already received. The second thing we would do is soothe. So we soothe the senses, okay? Engage those senses in a way that will soothe them. So we'll leave this slide for a minute and we'll go to the next slide, which is, what do we need to do about the sensory system? So I think we really need to get back to our senses. That's us and children, get back to our senses. And we have become a society that literally has minimized, if not eliminated, the forms of play that strengthen the sensory systems of children. So somewhere along the line, which was the 1980s, we made a decision that to know things was more important than to experience things, to be in the world. So when you start talking about regulatory functions, and you need to calm the senses, that's a listing of your senses. And so there are actually 7 senses. So I know in our STEM world, we teach young children that there's 5 senses, but there's actually 7. And so the first 2 fall under move. And the 2 senses under there are called proprioception and vestibular. So proprioception is really about, you know, body position in space, where is your head in relationship to gravity, those sorts of things. And that type of experience and balance is stimulated through heavy work. So one of the things that we would want to be doing with children that are coming from the brainstem is making sure that there is heavy work in our environment. And these opportunities for kids should be readily available to them, because when they're unregulated, they're not gonna stop and ask, oh, can I please, like, go find water. They have to be readily available. So heavy work is anything like pushing, pulling, dragging, lifting, carrying things that are heavy. And you say, what role does proprioception play in terms of regulatory functions? It is responsible for, the proprioceptive sense is responsible for not only your body awareness and your coordination, but in regulation, it's responsible for inhibition. So it's responsible for our ability to inhibit impulses from bursting forward. It's responsible for our brain's ability to inhibit explosive emotional reactions to things. And so one of the best things we can do as we cultivate this environment for regulation for children to get them ready for the skills that they will need is create opportunities for heavy work. And that could be anything from what we call chair push-ups, which is just putting your hands on your chair and trying to push your body weight up off the chair, to having children carry like a waste basket and emptying it, which is heavy for young children. You know, my generation, it was called chores. Like at 4 years old, you carried in the groceries and the milk bottles were glass, but nobody seemed to be too concerned about that. It was just like, there's four of them, so keep going to get three more left. But, you know, it's a different world. So I suppose for a lot of kids, carrying their backpack is heavy work. If we could get adults to understand that it's good for children to carry their backpacks and stop carrying it for them. So it's just, you know, anything that in, you know, previous generations, we did a lot of good things. And I'm not going back to be nostalgic, but there are some things that we really need to revisit. And one of the things we need to revisit is playgrounds, because the monkey bars used to be heavy work. Like nobody had to tell us to do heavy work. You just did it. We don't see that anymore. And then the vestibular sense is about balance. And so, you know, being able to keep focus. And so the purpose of the strengthening of the vestibular system, which actually is in the inner ear, is it regulates hyperactivity and it regulates distractibility. So what I just said to you is if you know any children that have ADHD, the first place you would start. Because personally, I'm tired of two-year-olds being diagnosed with ADHD and put on Ritalin. But the first place we would start is movement and have them do a lot of proprioceptive work and a lot of vestibular work, because those are the three components of ADHD, the diagnosis. So getting children into, you know, things that involve balance. So sometimes it's having kids sit on different types of seating. One of the challenges in a lot of quality measures in the different states is that they don't want stools for kids. They don't want, like, just get them a chair with the back. The problem with that is then they rely on the back to hold them in an upright position, and they don't develop the core muscles. And the core muscles are actually the foundation to regulatory functions. So the muscles that are in your stomach, your abdomen, the muscles that are in the pelvic floor, and the muscles that are in your back. And so it is good for kids once in a while to be sitting on stools or on wobbles where they have to sort of maintain their own balance. And then the next sense that you see is touch. And children love to touch. I don't think we have to tell folks that. I think children love to touch. It's one of the fundamental senses. And when we start looking at touch, basically the purpose of touch is it's the foundation to emotional security. And so in a world where we have this zero tolerance policy to touch, or in the world of COVID, when we have to say, 6 feet apart, I was just talking to people from around the country on, I guess it was Sunday or Saturday or something. And, some of those programs have been open because they were essential programs. And they were given directives from their state to not touch infants. You have to stay 6 feet from infants. And so here's what one director said. She said, you know, we tried to do what they told us to do, which was to sanitize everything within 1 second of a child touching something, you had to sanitize it and let it air dry for 10 minutes before anybody else could touch it. She said, and not touching infants. She said, and then I looked at my team and I said, you know what? We're just going to do what we do with children and don't do anything that's going to freak the parents out enough that they won't send their kids here again. And so I don't know how you do work, especially with infants and toddlers, without touch. I think that's going to be one of the greatest challenges. Like, how do you figure that out? Because kids need to be touched. And then sight is a way in which we can regulate through the sensory system. So, you know, what are the sights? I would have you think about this for yourself. So let's go back to movement. What movements actually help you as an adult to regulate and stay regulated? So we talked about, you know, proprioception and vestibular, but there's others like rotary movement. There's some people that like twirl their hair, that's rotary movement. There's some people that when they cross their legs, their foot is going around in circles. That's rotary movement. There is also inverted, that's upside down. There are some folks that regulate through linear movement, which is forward and backward and side to side. And that used to be the swings on the playground, except we took those away because that's not safe. So that's going to be my fourth book. That's the title. It's called, but, you know, I have to get an audio cover because I don't know how to spell that. But that's the title. We're in the world of anxiety these days. And we also have, you know, oscillation. Oscillation is up and down. That used to be our seesaws. And the rotary used to also be the merry-go-round. You'd run as fast as you could, and you got on. And if you were good, you got on. And if not, we dragged you. You know, we had all of these as part of our playgrounds. But then we got so sophisticated with our playgrounds that we lost most of that. And so now we have to create these opportunities for children to get these kinds of experiences because they're not naturally occurring for many children. So what movements of those movements help you to regulate? That's where we always start. We start with us so that we understand how important these things are to regulation. What touches help you to regulate? Because some people like deep pressure touch, other people like light touch, some people like no touch, particularly without advance notice. What sights help you to regulate? When you see something, your brain automatically goes to like, oh. What are those sights? What are the sounds that help you to regulate? So sometimes it's hard to figure that out. So I have a friend that's up in Vermont and I said to her, you know, Robin, what's the sound that helps you to regulate? What's your favorite sound? And she said, the sound of me eating potato chips. Now, if she were a child, I could have done a functional behavioral assessment from now until that child was 58 years old and not have figured that out. But I don't know what the sound is. Sometimes it's the sound of a person's voice. Sometimes it's the sounds of nature. Taste is a way to regulate the sensory system. So what are the tastes? Generally, things that are sweeter tend to calm as opposed to those that tend to be sour. And then smell is a way to regulate. In fact, smell is the fastest way to regulate the sensory system. However, we have regulatory people that don't like us to use any scents these days, and I get that. I understand that there are kids with lots of allergies and things like that. But it's a way for us to begin to regulate. Smell goes directly to the emotional part of the brain. The others get filtered through different places. And so here's the critical question, and then I'll move forward. The critical question, as we create this environment that's going to help to soothe the sensory system, the brainstem of children, the critical question is, for that child, what movements help them to regulate? Do they need somebody to rock with them? Do they need somebody to play games with them like Ring Around the Rosie? because that gives them rotary movement? Do they need games like London Bridge where take the keys and lock them up and they're going back and forth, which tends to be linear movement? You know, is this a child that needs oscillation? Like we used to have the small trampolines and maybe you guys still do, I don't know. What kind of movement? And if you'll watch the children, they will actually answer that question for you. A lot of what we're describing as misbehavior in children or dysregulation in children is actually their best attempt at regulation at the age that they're at. So they're telling us the clues. The second question you need to answer for that child would be, what touches help this child to regulate? Help them to find balance. What are the touches? And the way to find that out, just put out a variety of baskets of different materials. Now, ages comes into play because choking and all of that sort of stuff. But, you know, you may want to have a basket that just has different types of fabrics in it. And you might want another basket that just has different materials from nature in it. And you might want to have another basket that just has different types of fidget things like push balls and those sorts of things. And just watch what the children gravitate toward. What they gravitate toward is going to become a tool for you to help them to regulate. They're gravitating to it because it actually helps their brain. Third question is, what sites help them to regulate? What we know from research is that for most children, what helps them to regulate is the sites of nature, particularly woodlands, greenery, and water. So if we are inclined to have quiet areas for children and we send children there, it will be helpful not to have wheels of feelings on the wall, but to have photographs of nature. For young children, animals are a great calmer of their brains. So you can go through those senses and you can ask those questions. So what sounds help this child to regulate? What tastes help this child to regulate? What smells help this child to regulate? And once you know what those are, those become part of your environment. They're readily available to the child so that they don't have to ask. Because it's like us in a state of rage saying, oh, is it okay if I tell you I'm feeling enraged right now? Like the likelihood of that happening is about zero. So if we go back to the triune brain, which is the previous slide, now we'll do the work with the limbic system. And that limbic system is all about the emotional part of the brain. And so as we look at that part of the brain, how will you know if a child is coming from that part of the brain? And then we'll talk about what we do about it, okay? So when a child is in that midbrain or the limbic part of the brain, we call that the mammalian brain. Generally, it's mastering between the ages of 15 months and 5 years old, the end of the fifth year. But what are the behaviors that you see that will tell you that the emotional part of the brain is struggling? Whining is something that you'll be hearing, whining. Clinging, you will experience. Not listening. Resisting. The kids that you can't make me, you're not the boss of me. You're going to see ordering. There are some children that will start to order everybody around. So you may see these kids that clean up time and they're like, hey, they're not cleaning. Hey, they're not cleaning. Hey, and they're not, you know, the child themselves aren't cleaning either, but don't bring that up because that'll put them into further dysregulation. Just tell them to clean. They're not cleaning. Hey, do something. So they'll be ordering people around. This is where you're going to start to see behaviors like speeding up. Increased restlessness, sort of running around, ping-ponging around. You'll experience crying when it's coming from the brainstem. And then you may experience laughing. So these are the children that, you know, if we're trying to give them feedback on something and they're actually laughing in our face and running away from us. Or they could just be laughing as you know, this is joyful because that's part of the limbic system. So when we see those types of behaviors, we say, okay, so now this is coming from the emotional part of the brain. So what do I do to help that part of the brain to get itself back into balance? The first thing that we do is slow down. Start talking softer. start talking more slow, you know, slowly. We have a statement in my business that says adults should never become the child's stimulant. That means you have to be incredibly regulated. This is when people say, you know, we want you to be calm and neutral. It's like, do you know how hard that is to do when a kid is like been crying for 6 hours and clinging to us? But it's required. So slow down. The next thing we would say is connect. Connect to what? Connect to the heart of the child. We're not in the sensory part of it anymore. We're in the heart. Connect to the heart of the child. So how do we connect to the heart of the child? Empathize. Empathize. So as we start looking at emotions, I'm going to do a little bit of work with you around emotions. There's a lot of information out there about emotions. Some of the more common and popular things that are being taught right now are not very helpful for young children. In fact, they can be very damaging for young children. But I'll just say to you that there are six emotions. Okay, there's six. Any other word of the 606 that we have in the English language are all variations of six emotions. And we are one of the only countries that has that many words. And so when we start to do work with emotional development of children, we stick with what we call the pure emotions. So you say, what are the pure emotions? And the two pure emotions are called joy and fear. They are the emotions that you experience at the point of birth. And so we all enter the world in fear. Fear of falling and fear of loud noises. And then once we're cleaned up a little bit and we're swaddled and put to a breast or a bottle, then joy comes forward. It's not that we don't have the other emotions. We have all six emotional networks at the time we're born. But those are the first emotions before the world socializes us in certain ways, okay? And then when you are working with infants and toddlers, those are the words that we introduce. Those are the first two words, scared and happy, scared and happy. And when children start to get older, toddlers, and through the preschool years, you add two other emotions. Those emotions are called mad and sad. So if you looked at it as sort of like a flow, you would have joy on this side, you would have fear on this side, and then underneath fear, you would put mad and sad. So there's three on one side and one on the other. Okay, now the brain works in such a way that you can't be in joy, scared, mad, or sad at the same time. They're incompatible to each other. So if we would create an environment that's a playful, low stress, lighthearted kind of environment, then we would see less of scared, mad, and sad. But those three emotions protect us. They're emotions of protection, where joy is an emotion of extending pleasure. Okay. So when you have those four emotions, until the age of 8 years old, those are the only four emotions that we talk with kids about. That's it. Those four. They're called the basic emotions. And then if you're working with children older than eight, then you can add in surprise and disgust, which are the last two of the six emotional networks of the brain. Okay. So when we talk about calming the limbic system, putting that part of the brain back into balance, what does that mean? The first set of skills is called identification. It's teaching children the vocabulary of emotions and the ability to discriminate between them. So as we do identification with kids, which is beginning in toddlerhood, and it continues until they enter elementary school. That's the primary work of emotional competence, the development of emotional competence in young children, the teaching of identification. So what do we do when we say empathize with a child? What does that mean? It means this, that you have to connect by, there's a statement out there that says we should acknowledge and validate emotions. That is not true. We should acknowledge and validate the thought that precedes the emotion and then normalize the emotion. Okay? So it's a different pattern. And this is some of the teaching that's out there that I think is harmful to children. We believe that if we teach kids to say, I feel mad, that they have emotional competence. But unless they understand that it's their thoughts that actually governs their emotions, like you don't pick what emotion you feel. Whatever you're thinking generates a chemistry for an emotion, and that's the emotion you feel. It's governed by your thoughts. So when we say, validate the thought, here's the thoughts. The thought of the emotion of joy or happy is this is fun. Okay? So whenever we as human beings believe something is fun, we experience joy and happy. The thought pattern for fear is, I'm not safe. So whenever we feel we're not safe, we experience fear. The thought pattern for anger is this is not right or fair. So somebody cuts me in line, it's not fair. You tell me no, that's not fair either. So that's why young children experience a lot more anger than somebody my age. It's like, by the time you're my age, it's like, your whole life hasn't been fair. So like, just get over it, move on. Doesn't matter. And the thought pattern of sadness is loss. I have lost, or I'm about to lose something. And so when I said to you earlier, you know, I think what we're gonna see in our children is heightened anger. I think we're gonna see heightened fear. And I think we're going to see heightened sadness in children. Because when you look at the thoughts, there are children that don't feel like they're safe. I've been doing a lot of parent stuff, and there's a lot of parents that are at their wit's end and screaming at their kids all day long because they can't get their two-hour conference call required by their work done because their three-year-old won't play for 2 hours quietly by themselves. So they're screaming at kids. So, like, I don't know what's going on in houses. I just know with what's going on in the houses of the families I've been working with, I do think that we're also going to have children in heightened anger. It's not fair if you can't see people in your family that you usually have access to. Like, why do I have to look at my grammy and my grandpa through a window and I can't hug them? Why don't they come visit me on Sunday like they used to, or Saturday like they used to? Like, why can't I go to, you know, synagogue or to temple or to, you know, mosque or to church or to, why? Like, why? It's not fair. This is just part of my life. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And so, you know, and I also think we're going to see children in sadness because as tragic as it is, some of these children have lost people very close to them as a result of this. If they haven't lost them permanently, they've lost them temporarily. And so I think we are going to have a fair share of that. So when we say, you know, a child is in the limbic system, connect and empathize, what I would recommend you do is to validate the thought and then normalize the emotion. So it looks to me like you're mad, you're feeling mad, and we feel mad when something's not fair. I know a lot of kids that when they haven't seen their Grammy, they feel mad too. That's normalizing the emotion. It's a whole different pattern. You have to get the thought connected to the feeling because the feelings are too abstract for the kids. And they grow up and be adults that have no idea why they're mad and get triggered by the same things over and over and over again because nobody ever told them you get triggered by that because you're perceiving it as not fair. It's an injustice. Okay, so connect and empathize. And then once the child is calmed down, reflect. So as we teach the skills, now that's what we would do, what the slow down, the connect, the empathize, and the reflect are things we would do at the moment of dysregulation of a moment, of the emotion. As we move to the teaching of that so that children eventually can regulate their own emotions, what you see on the slide is the teaching points. So how do we actually teach the skill of identification to children? There's four teaching points, and a child has not mastered this skill class until they have demonstrated mastery of these four teaching points. So everybody has feelings. Children need to know, it doesn't matter how old you are, everybody feels happy sometimes, everybody feels sad sometimes, everybody feels mad sometimes, and everybody feels scared sometimes. Everybody does. Now, why do I tell you that? Because when you make materials to teach these teaching points, you will have to make them. Because as you see on that slide, you look at those pictures and you look at, that doesn't look like everybody. That doesn't look like everybody. They all seem to be of similar age. So people of my generation are not represented there. People of infancy may not be represented. Everybody has feelings. So most of the materials that are commercially produced, although I've been working with Kaplan and Lakeshore for 6 years now on stuff, have bias to them. And they deliver the wrong messages to kids. So the best thing to do is to make your own materials. Just take photographs of people of a bunch of different ages and make your own posters. But everybody has feelings. Teaching point number two, feelings come from somewhere. And you now know that your feelings come from your thoughts. So when we think a certain thing, the chemistry automatically shifts. The brain involuntarily puts us into whatever the emotion is. The only thing we have control over is the thought, but we also have control over for how long we experience the emotion and how we express it. But we do not choose what emotion we experience and when we experience it. So they come from your thoughts. The third teaching point is it's not always easy to know what you feel. And that's because there's things called blended emotions. Blended emotions get introduced to children around the age of 8 years old. The blended emotion is things like jealous. Jealous is when we feel scared, mad, and sad at the same time. Embarrassed is a blended emotion. It's when you feel sad and scared at the same time. So we don't introduce that to children until they're at least 8 years old. Although in the current model that's out there, they think that we should be teaching kids things like they should be worried, but worried is a thought pattern. It's not even an emotion. So, and then the last teaching point is there are clues that tell us what we feel. Now, this is also where I think we get into trouble, because when you look at the chart that's up there that says, how do you feel? It's only faces, but there are a lot of clues. Your emotions are expressed throughout the whole body. And there are other clues that can tell us what we're feeling or what somebody else is feeling. It might not be the face. You have to think about things like the voice. So for how many of us does our voice change when we're happy? And do you have a different voice when you're sad? And do you have a different voice when you're mad? Do you have a different voice? What happens to your voice when you're scared and you're happy? What happens to your hands? What do you do with your feet when you're mad? And so if we teach kids that you can tell if somebody's mad by looking at their face, and if their teeth are gritted, that they're mad, I guess I've never been mad. Because my face doesn't change when I'm mad, but my feet do something. They walk away from you. So for some kids, their feet stomp. For some kids, their hands do something. They push or they throw. So I think it's being more expansive and letting kids know that sometimes you can't tell how somebody feels by their face. Have you ever, as an adult, had an experience where somebody's smiling, but they're talking about something serious, and it creates this like, wait a minute, are they serious? Like, is this a disconnect? It's called code switching. They're in the wrong code. So for most of us, the skill class that we're going to be working on is identification. Helping these children to develop the vocabulary and be able to discriminate between mad, sad, glad, and scared. And then we just gave you a listing of some examples of activities that you could do, and you can look all these up in different books and things. But get children practicing work with emotions. And then the next thing that I'll share with you, and I'll do it quickly because modulation is the next skill class in emotions regulation. Modulation is understanding that emotions always start really small and they grow really big. And in young children, they grow really big, really fast. But it's also, once they grow really big, how do I make them small again? And for a lot of young children, this is against some of what we've been taught in tradition, which is, you know, when a child is that out of control, send them to a place where they can calm themselves down. The reality is you should never leave a child in that intensity of emotion alone, ever. If they had the skills to regulate, they would do it. But they're still in the stage of co-regulation or external supports, which means I need an adult. I need to rely on an adult. I can't do this by myself. And if we ask them to do it by themselves, you're going to see children that will start to suppress their emotions, which could lead to all kinds of disease later on. Or they're going to be children that will feel abandoned. They'll go into the intensity of fear. So modulation, it's understanding the degree of feeling. So it's when we start to introduce to children that there's a whole bunch of different words that describe the same emotion. So you can be scared, you can be panicked, you can be terrified, you can be terrorized. All different words or intensities of words that describe the strength of an emotion. You can be angry, or you can be annoyed, you can be frustrated, you can be enraged, you can be all different intensities. Gets too confusing for little kids, which is why I'm only going to cover it so that you know what the next step would be for some of these children. But basically, we don't start teaching modulation until children are somewhere around 6 or 7 years old. It's the ability to manage their feelings regardless of the intensity effectively. And sometimes it's creating feelings toolboxes for kids. So when we work with young children, what do we do with modulation? If they're not able to develop and master these skills because of their developmental age and where their brain is in its development, then what do? We give kids outlets. Okay. You give them ways to express their emotions. You never want emotions to be suppressed, repressed, in any way. Emotions are to be expressed. But we want children to know how to do that in ways that are constructive to themselves, to property, to other people, relationships. Okay? So when you look at this list here, some of the things that we would use with younger children, the first two we do not do with younger children. Number scales and thermometers. That's for the older kids. But materials, so any sensory materials. So your fidgets, any exploratory sensory kinds of materials, your waters, your clay, goop, anything from nature, fabrics, those sorts of things we would offer to children. Relaxation, you can try it with young kids, but I don't know a lot of young kids that are going to stop and put their hand on their belly and breathe deep 3 times because I'm an adult and I don't do that. Movement is your best modulator for children. It is the best. Movement and touch. The last two are the best for children, other than the exploratory materials, which would come in into play for them. So making sure, so things like drumming is very calming for some children. Anything to do with water? Water is the most calming medium for the human body. Whether we drink water, we hear water, we play in water. That's why I tell parents right now, your kids need 2 or 3 baths a day because they are at their wit's end. So quickly, I'm just going to shift over. So that's a little bit about what we need to know about the regulation of emotions. Not going to get into the cortex because that's 16 years old. And unless you're working with children that are adolescents and moving into young adulthood, you don't need the expression piece. But this impulse control is part of what we call behavioral regulation. So you go from physiological regulation, the sensory system, to emotional regulation, which we just did a little bit with. And then you go into behavioral regulation, which is the regulation of impulses, activity level, and attention span. Okay, so that's your developmental progression. So how do we help children to regulate their impulses? Basically, young children are exuberant and they're supposed to be spontaneous. And that's what we experience. So the regulation of impulses really begins to master in the elementary years. But here's some things we can do with kids to get them ready. Practice substitution and postponement. So what that means is, I know you would like it right now. I hear you asking for it. It's not available right now, so I can offer you this instead. That's substitution, okay? But I want that bike. I know you want that bike. It's not available to you right now, but there's 3 other bikes. I can offer you one of those. Doesn't mean they're gonna accept it. We're just getting them ready, okay? Postponement is, I know you want it right now. How about if we set the timer for 5 minutes and in 5 minutes it will be available? And over time, you gradually extend the amount of time that they have to delay. Okay. The next thing we would do around getting children into impulse control is ask open-ended questions. Stay away from the questions of yes and no. So instead of saying, we're going outside, would you like to get your coat on? We ask, we're going outside, what's the first thing you need to do to get yourself ready? And then as they move into the preschool years, you can start saying, and then add the second step. And then once they can do the second step, and what next? Okay. So up to 3-step, open-ended. So you're getting them ready to move into planning and executive functions and those sorts of things by asking open-ended questions. But when you ask those, it requires them to stop and think, which is where the impulse control comes in. The next one says play the what if game. The what if game is getting children to begin to think about possible alternatives. So what if you use that word on the playground? Well, what do you think kids would do? What if you decided, or you saw 2 kids that were hurting each other on the playground, what do you think would be the best thing to do? Just come up with hypothetical questions and have children start to reflect on what they think the possibilities are. The next thing, play games with stop and start actions. That's your red light, green light. It's duck, duck, goose for your toddlers. It's freeze tag. It's the freeze dance. It's all of those things. Statue. You know, all the games, hide and go seek. And then there is no research that says relaxation actually helps young children with impulse control. But you can try it if you'd like to, because a lot of people are into mindfulness, so they think if they do downward dog, then we're going to get regulated kids. But we only do it on Friday circle because we got to do letter of the week every other day. So that's kind of the way it turns out for a lot of people. But the real thing that does help is mindfulness, which is a science, a whole art. It's not just relaxation, but it's about awareness. So with that said, we'll stop. We'll answer questions if folks have questions. For those of you that need to sign off, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Hope you found this helpful in some way. And if we can be of help to you and you need additional information, please feel free to connect with us and we'll get you what we have available to move things along.
Thank you so much, Janine, for that extraordinarily thoughtful presentation. We have a number of questions, and I have a funny feeling that they're going to be the same questions you get all the time. So the first question in a certain way, right? And they come out of the womb a certain way.
Yeah.
At age, which there's really no point in trying to teach anything, you know, or do you, you know, when you have that twos toddler room, is it like?
Yeah. Well, I think we're always trying to teach, and we want to teach the skills that can transform kids' lives in the best possible ways. I think the point that becomes critically important is don't expect mastery. Don't expect immediate response, because developmentally, you know, we're asking them to do things that their brain might not be capable of doing.
Right.
So when you think of the brainstem, like, that doesn't master until 15 months of age. And that's the sensory part, the most primitive part of the brain. So we have a lot of teaching to do. We can't lose patience. You know, and we really have to step back and question, like, why am I asking them to sit crisscross applesauce? Like, who sits that way? Like, is it really that important if they're in their own space? And so that's the point that I think we need to step back and do some reflection around is, you can teach whatever you want to teach and try to teach. It doesn't mean there's going to be mastery.
And then kind of on the flip, because we see so much variation in a typical classroom, mm-hmm. when might you think maybe it's time, maybe whatever is happening in the classroom is not enough, and maybe there needs to be intervention from the outside?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the difference between developmental behaviors and challenging behavior. And there's a whole definition to those. Most children are still in developmental behaviors, which means the behavior is serving a purpose and we expect to see it during that developmental stage. Nonetheless, difficult when you have a group of people in developmental behaviors. Challenging behavior is when we start to look out for the outside intervention. Challenging behavior means that the behavior doesn't serve the development of the child like developmental behaviors do. It actually interferes with the child's ability to function. And so oftentimes it's a behavior or pattern that is interfering with their ability to form and maintain relationships, or it could put them at risk for like school retention or failure, like some of the toddlers that are being asked to leave program after program after program. And then, you know, they get to the transition to kindergarten and people are like, are they ready? Like, should I send them there? Or any behavior that has the intention, and that's the critical word, intention to cause harm to the child themselves or their property is considered challenging behavior. But I think another time that we would look for outside intervention has to do with us as professionals. When we find that our own regulation is becoming a problem, like we can't regulate ourselves, then it's time to ask for intervention. And not so much intervention related to the children, but intervention related to help me to stay regulated. So how do I grow professionally? So, you know, like if anger becomes too intense, too frequent, or, you know, you have a child in your class that triggers you into fear. Fear for yourself, fear for property, fear for other kids, and you don't seem to be able to handle that, then you would ask for help.
Okay, thank you. And then the last question I'm going to ask you is, in terms of introducing the sensory kind of inputs to help with regulation, it sounds like from what you're saying that theoretically, factors that can soothe, calm, satisfy one child could do the opposite for another.
That's right.
So when you're in a classroom, is it the case that you kind of have to identify everybody's sensory set?
Yeah, depending upon the age that you're working with. If you're working with your infants and toddlers, you definitely want to know the sensory threshold of those kids, because that's where most of the trigger is. As you move into the preschool years, you know, you can start to figure out it's only a certain number of kids, and those are the ones I would spend most time on figuring that out. But once you figure what that is, A lot of these things that I'm talking about, and if we had more time, we could go into, but are things that you can just incorporate in a preventative kind of way throughout the day, in your typical day. So if you find that there's a, you know, more than one child that needs more movement, the general rule of thumb is 5 minutes for every 20 to 25 minutes of low mobility. And so you might look at your schedule and say, okay, so I have three kids that need rotary movement. I think right after I do this, then we're going to play. And then it just becomes part of your curriculum. Or you have, like I said earlier, you have baskets of materials, variety, and the children will know which ones to go to. So once you figure out the patterns, basically what it requires is for us to honor the sensory need of the child, and that need being of the same intensity as our needs. Like, don't deny needs. We can't always do what's convenient or what other people think meets checklists. Sometimes we have to do what's required beyond that.